You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and Dr. Melody Fox is off today. She's celebrating her extended birthday weekend. Melody, happy birthday. I hope you had a wonderful birthday weekend. And she'll be back with us next week, folks. And just so everybody knows, we're just going to remind you again, each week we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. With each of us, Melody and I, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. We will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, in today's economy, I think everybody knows a college degree is more important and, unfortunately, more expensive than ever. Today, we'll be talking about the financial side of college. Our guest today is Ruth Vedvik. She is the co-author of The Financial Aid Handbook, Getting the Education You Want for the Price You Can Afford. Ruth has worked for 35 years in the college admissions and financial aid industry and for the past 10 years as a principal at Hardwick Day, an enrollment consulting firm that works with the admission and financial aid offices of private colleges and universities. Ruth has extensive experience in the public sector as the director of admission at Ball State University, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and Agnes Scott College. In her extensive consulting practice, Ruth has assisted colleges and universities with recruitment, selection, communication, and the development and implementation of financial aid policy. Ruth, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on your show today.
Well, we're glad to have you. And again, as I was just saying recently, that the combination of us being during the summer, a lot of kids going to getting ready to go to college or getting prepared to go to college, and the fact that our economy has put us in a position to where we don't really have the money that we had before. I know in dealing with families in the past, a lot of them were mortgaging their homes so that they could get their child off to college. Well, as we all know, most of our homes don't have any money to mortgage now. So I think that the timing for your book is just perfect. So I would assume, is that the reason you chose to write the book and you chose to write it now?
And actually, that's correct. And Carol and I started, my co-author Carol Stack, and I started on this project actually really before the economy turned upside down on us. And it's the idea for the book is one that we've bounced around in our heads for years and years and years as we've watched students and their families make decisions about going to college that were not cost aware or cost conscious. And then those very students ended up with so much debt that by the time they graduated from college, they really couldn't go out and live the American dream. They had so much debt, they had to move home and live in their parents' basement. And as an empty nester, I can tell you, it's a great place to be in life. The other big part of the success of the book right now is that it's very real time and real language. We've written it, so we've taken all of our jargon and our lingo that we use in financial aid in particular, and we've written that right out of the book. So it's plain English, plain language for people that maybe have never been through this process themselves, or maybe this is the oldest child going on to school. So the words that we use in higher education actually find some meaning in our book because we explain them in real words.
Well, and I can vouch for that, and I have a copy of it here, and I was able to get through about a third of it here in this week as I prepared for this show, and that was one of the things that I really appreciated was I really felt like it was talking to me, and I have two teenage boys that are going to be hopefully getting ready to go to college. But if I felt that it was talking to me and it was in a language that I felt real comfortable with.
Good. I'm very glad about that. We really, our target market was high school kids, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, and a language that wouldn't be so boring, it would just have them close the book really after the first page. And we did write a chapter really only for parents, actually an introduction as well, but a chapter for parents. There are two really important chapters in this book, and it's sitting down to have the very difficult conversation about money. So we wrote a chapter for kids saying, here's what you do. Here's a good way to start the conversation. Here's what you need to talk about. And we did the same thing for parents. And we actually tell everybody to read each other's chapters, too. But you know what? In this day, there are as many blended families as there are kind of the original biological mom and dad and then their kids. And one of the hardest things about getting financial aid is figuring out who's supposed to pay for what when you have families with divorced parents and with step-parents. And we've worked really hard to clarify all of that so you know who's obligated to pay for what and who isn't, according to Uncle Sam, because actually the federal government could care less about your divorce agreement and what you say you are responsible for when it comes to your 18-year-old plus child. And we just tell you what the feds are going to do in regard to what they expect you to pay.
Yeah, and I like that. And by the way, I do plan on having my 17-year-old read it as well.
Great.
I didn't have time to give it to him beforehand, so I figured I was going to wait and give it to him immediately after.
Good. Well, I'd love to have you shoot me an email and tell you what you think. We have had a lot of students. We've passed it around for kids to read, and they like the stories. They say that they're using it kind of as a book, but that's more like a menu. When I need this information, I'm going to file the FAFSA. I'm going to come back and read the basics chapter because that's when I'll have to remember that stuff. But having a conversation right now, if you have a student, for your listeners, a student who is a rising senior, going to start the senior year of high school, now is the time to start thinking about not just what college to go to, but what college can you afford to send your student to. And we actually challenge the former paradigm, or maybe it's the paradigm that exists today, that really your student should go out and find the perfect school and fall in love and then figure out if you can get in and figure out what it's going to cost to go there. And that's really the heartbreak of the REACH school myth, is that kids will fall in love with a school and then maybe they can get in. But here's the story about a REACH school. The students, it's logical, if it's a REACH school, it means it's not very likely you're going to be admissible. Your academic history, your grades, your test scores, your class rank are at the very bottom of the admitted student profile. So getting in is a real reach, and you're so happy to get in that people for decades have said, if you get into your REACH school, you should go because it's the best school you could go to. And when you finish, you will have more opportunities, more whether it's for graduate school or better jobs or whatever. Well, we did the return on investment, the ROI on that, mm-hmm. across the country. And really, frankly, unless you're talking about an Ivy League school or maybe a handful of other schools, we could not document any financial benefit from going to the bigger name, the more expensive school. And if you're at the bottom of the profile, typically students are just so happy to get in, they find a way to pay for it. And the schools will not give you any merit-based aid, because you're not academically deserving to them, and they will give you need-based aid. But if you're a family in that middle-income range, that's not going to be a lot of free money or merit or need-based money. So it's a tough choice to make, and those kids can end up $100,000 in debt, and that loan payment is going to preclude going out and getting an apartment or kind of living the American dream.
Now, taking that into consideration, what about the child that wants a particular specialty? You know, there's a particular thing that they want to, I mean, we all know, you know, it's like if it's music or acting or whatever, you know, the Juilliard and things like that. But what if it's a specific thing that they want? You know, is it best to go and find, say, it's marketing? What are the top marketing schools? How is the best way to do that if they want a specific thing?
You know, if your students are very, very certain about what they're going to go into, then they should look for a college or university that offers that specific program. Now, let's start off with a large majority of freshmen change their minds probably three times. And okay. And maybe on the average, and I'm just going to shoot this off the top of my head, maybe 20% of the enrolling freshmen really major in what they put on their application for admission. And so you have to be really certain, and that's hard for an 18-year-old to do, as you would well know, just listening to your introduction. And so where it's really important would be a student who says, I want to major in nursing or physical therapy or one of the applied health sciences. Mm-hmm. And those are certification programs that have very restricted enrollments. They're difficult to gain access to, and not every school has them. So if you're pretty sure you want to be in PT or in nursing, then you need to build a list of schools that offer a nursing or a PT program. A lot of students go to physical therapy, though, as a graduate program or mm-hmm. an extension of their undergrad. They finish a four-year degree and then go on to physical therapy school. And so in that case, it's just very important you go to school with a good, strong science program. Now, you know, when you talk about business, the majority of the, it was called the highbrow or the elite Fortune 500 companies who are hiring the very best and the brightest coming out of business schools, mm-hmm. typically they want somebody with an MBA or graduate program in that particular field. And so finding a really good, solid business program as an undergraduate option or an economics major or a finance major will do you more to get you into those really high-profile name brand graduate schools like the Wharton School or, you know, some of the others you've heard of. And so just go to a school that will fund you, as we say in the book. And that means it's very similar to graduate education, that they want you as much as you want them. In other words, your academic credentials put you in the top, let's say, 20 or 25% of their enrolling student population. So they're going to give you a lot of merit-based scholarship to enroll. That also means you are very capable of earning a very high GPA, and that's you need that as much as a prestigious undergraduate school to gain access to those very high-profile programs or physical therapy school or medical school or wherever it is you're headed. And so it's a combination of finding a school with the right academic programs for you and a school where you can be very successful because you're going to have to pull a pretty high GPA to get into those really high-profile programs.
Okay. Well, now let me ask a question that maybe fits to a more middle-of-the-road GPA, the person that didn't end up getting the greatest grades and maybe not even because they weren't smart enough, but they just didn't take high school seriously enough. What's the best way for them to approach this?
I would say, a little differentiation here in that different colleges and universities have different academic profiles or requirements for admission. So a student who is in the middle of the boat may be hovering around a B average or 3.0, so they're not going to gain access to, well, let's say in California, probably, you know, Berkeley, UCLA, or some of the other UCs that are so competitive for admission.
Mm-hmm.
It's important, first of all, to figure out where you fit. So sit down with all of your academic credentials and maybe a high school counselor. And we have a methodology that we've written into the book that's called the MAP or the Merit Aid Profile, and this would work well, where you plot out who you are and then you map it against information that you can find on the web. There's actually two or three websites that we point students to and we tell them what information you need. And it tells you whether or not you'll get in, and it tells you how much financial aid you'd get. So for students who are in the middle, they'll mm-hmm. find schools where the majority of their enrolling students are from the middle,
mm-hmm.
and you'll be able to get in and probably get some funding to go there. And then the key is, in getting in, is be honest, talk about yourself, talk about why you're in the middle academically, why your grades, maybe they're not bad, but you're not up there with the straight-A kids. And you might be able to point to some things about yourself. Maybe you founded the Green Club at school, mm-hmm. or Students Against Drunk Driving, or other initiatives that took a lot of your time. Maybe you're really a great athlete or a great musician, and you've been in all the high school musicals, and boy, doesn't that take a lot of time. And so I think in writing to the admission committee, you point out the other things about you that make you a very special student and very desirable to the institution. Right. And then the other part is to say, okay, I'm ready to grow up and understand I have to put in equal time to my academic endeavors. So my goal is to graduate with a whatever GPA.
Okay. So for instance, if you have somebody that maybe was really, really active in their community, they were doing a lot of volunteer work, which the school is going to look at and go, well, this is good. This is a good character point, but yet they ended up with a B average. If they add to the end of that, to the end of their letter saying, you know, I recognize the fact that, you know, maybe I didn't put as much time as I could, you're saying that they're probably going to put some weight into that?
Absolutely.
That's great.
I was an admission dean for 17 years at many different types of institutions, including the University of Illinois, which is a public Ivy, and yeah, it's really hard to get into, kind of like getting into Berkeley. You know, it's the mm-hmm. land-grant university. It's where all the great engineering students are headed, but it's just hard to get in, period. And admission deans and directors will listen to that. Now, there are schools like the public Ivies for whom admission is more formulaic, and so it really is a combination of test score and class rank, and it's really hard to get the attention of the admission committee because they have so many applicants.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a little tougher ticket to punch if you're kind of a middle-of-the-road kid, unless you have a particular, like you're such a great oboist that their music director is going to be in looking for you and will talk to the admission director on your behalf. But for private colleges and universities, it's usually easier to get the attention of the admission dean because you'll have your own admission counselor and that person is your advocate. And so you have access to the folks who are going to make the decision. And we talk about our book not to be afraid of the private colleges and universities. The sticker price is more, but in the end what you pay, especially if you learn kind of how to find a school where you fit in and where they'll fund you, as we tell you in our book, you can often find a private college or university that will be a really great fit or match for you because the values of the institution match your values and mm-hmm. what you care about, your passions, as we talk about. And so if you think through it, and we think through it for you in the book, often it takes 5 years to finish at a public school because it's harder to get into the classes you want. If you change your major, it's kind of more like a do-over than just a little bit of a, you know, take path, you know, the y-axis instead of the X. And at a four-year school, you're more likely to get through in 4 years. The sticker price is more, but the actual net price that you pay may not be more, even with consideration of student loans. And so don't rule out those privates. You might find exactly the right school for you where you can be hugely successful and be a known person on campus.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it myth or fact that if you kind of, you know, didn't really put your best foot forward in high school, that you can sort of do a start over in and go to a junior college and crank out really good grades in junior college to then put you in a better position to get accepted into a college?
Oh, that is fact. Absolutely true. And we recommend it to students. And there are so many great two-year schools in our country, and there are schools that have multi-purposes. There, you'll find kids who were, you know, straight A in high school and really high-end academic performers, and their families are caught in the middle of this economic downturn, and they have maybe only one parent working or no parent working, and they found a way to go to community college for practically for free. In fact, I live in the state of Illinois, and in my district, if you're in the top 10% of your high school class, you can go to the community college for free.
Nice.
Beat that. And so kids are, in fact, my daughter, who has a very good friend who was graduated at the top of the class with her, has done that. She's gotten 2 years of schooling for free, and now she's moving on for four-year college and has all of her borrowing capacity available to her. And it's very important. In our book, we tell students, do not borrow more than $8,000 a year on the average, or $32,000 for 4 years of college.
Well, why is that? In fact, I was going to ask that as a question. You know, why $32,000 is a cap on student loan debt?
Well, we did a lot of national research. We found a lot of other experts who agreed with that, and principally because the financial folks will tell you that when you graduate from college, your first year, your debt should not equal, let's say, your first year's annual salary. It should be a one-for-one ratio against debt. And so on the average, you know, unless you're going to be a high-profile business person or an engineer, most of us are going to go out in the world and make the equivalent of $32,000 a year. Now, that's going to vary. You know, in L.A., it's a different starting salary than it is in Champaign, Illinois. But at $32,000 from borrowing from the Stafford Direct Loan, your payment's going to be about $348 a month. And most people could figure that into a budget.
Yeah,
and still
sense.
Rent an apartment and have a car or pay for transportation.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And I know earlier I had asked you in regards to a myth or fact. I noticed in your book you refer to myths, and the seven myths that you allude to in your book have drawn a lot of attention by interviewers across the country. In fact, one I know was Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch alluded to them as your common myths and mistakes. Share with them a little bit with our listeners.
Sure. In fact, we've already mentioned several, and we really enjoyed her take on that particular chapter and those seven myths, because if indeed you believe in the myth and you follow it because you think it's like an axiom or something you need to do, it can turn into a mistake. That the student who goes to her, gets into her REACH school and goes and ends up $100,000 in debt. That was a mistake. Another one that we kind of talked about already is wait until after I'm accepted to college and then figure out how to pay. And what we're putting out there is that's just not right, because you don't have to fall in love with a school you can't afford. We and the United States has a very unique higher education system. And because we have so much diversity, we have little tiny private colleges and universities, we have huge mega universities, and absolutely everything in between, from faith-based to non-denominational to very specialized kinds of places. You can go to St. John's College in Arizona, and in every month you read a great book, and the next month you read another great book, and you could do a whole year of just doing that. If you're the person that loves to read, that might be the place for you. Nowhere else in the world can you find that. And so, you know, we think it's important that in these myths, they talk about it all. There's one that says, if my parents just say they won't pay for my college, I'll get more financial aid. Oh, no, federal government's in charge there. They're not going to let your parents off the hook. It just probably means you're not going to be able to go. So that's another one of those. Sit down with your parents and do it early. We talk about the fact people believe that financial aid, the need-based financial aid, is only for the very poorest people. And that's not true at all. It's, you know, every year as we work with clients and their students and parents around the country, we have a lot of families who do go ahead and file the FAFSA, which is the free application for student aid. Mm-hmm. And it gets you access to the entitlement money from the federal government, like the Pell Grant. And also for the very low interest loans, the Stafford Direct, there's a subsidized and an unsubsidized. And it's amazing, families with even six-figure incomes will qualify for some kind of federal assistance, even if it's just the Stafford Direct subsidized loan, which means the federal government is paying the interest on your loan while you're in school and the first 6 months afterwards. And that's different than the unsub, which means the interest on that loan is accruing for the 4 years and you're in college. So it actually costs you some money, more money than the other.
It sounds like it. Now, what about these people that pop up sometimes on the internet that say if you pay them a small amount of money that they're going to find you a scholarship?
Oh, yeah, Alan, that's another great myth. It just don't ever do that, people. Do not pay someone money to find you a scholarship. It's all a scam. Go to fastweb.com, and you can find some recommendations for good links on our own website, thefinancialaidhandbook.com. And you can go onto the FastWeb site and do a great scholarship search for free.
Okay. Well, you people heard it. We're going to take a break. We're going to be right back. So do not go anywhere, because you're going to learn how to continue to be able to find colleges and find a tuition that fits your budget. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with. in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We are talking with Ruth Vedvik. She is the co-author of The Financial Aid Handbook, Getting the Education You Want for the Price You Can Afford. Now, Ruth, before we took a break, we were talking about some of the myths. So I think there was another myth that you alluded to in the book, and that is the one that says, my state school will always be the cheapest for me.
That's right. And in thinking through that, and I mentioned one of these things just a few minutes ago, that sometimes to go to public university, it takes more than, on the average, 4 years to graduate. And that fifth year or even a sixth year of college, it's not just your out-of-pocket costs that add up, how much you're paying for tuition, fees, room, and board, but it's the lost opportunity cost, because if you had finished in 4 years and you went into the workforce, you would be earning income instead of spending money to be at college. And so it can be more expensive to go to public school if you're not getting any free money or grant money, as we would say, scholarship money. And you find a private college or university who will partially fund you to attend their school, you can actually come out a little bit ahead on it financially.
Well, and I like that. That makes sense. I'm getting listener questions that have come up, and I've got one now that's come up through instant message. And this one touches on, I think you touched a little bit on the area of financial aid. What this one says is, with three teens, we are just overwhelmed by the cost to send them to college. I was excited to see this topic come up for Alan's show. Can you explain a little about financial aid and how families can qualify for this? So I know you were talking a little bit about it. Is there any benefit if you have three kids coming up at the same time?
Oh, absolutely. The free federal application for student aid will actually calculate the amount of money that your family can afford to pay for college for next year. And it's called the estimated family contribution. And what happens with this is the first year when you have one kid, unless you get twins or triplets, but one kid goes to school, that amount of money is applied against the total cost, tuition fees, room and board, books, supplies, travel. And that's the amount of money that you're expected to fund for your student to go to school. So as soon as you have sibling number two come along and is in school with sibling number one, the amount you're expected to pay is divided in half. And if you have three in school while you're there, the amount of money you're expected to pay is divided by three. Now, there are some really interesting rules about what is expected to be paid from your income, your assets, and other money that you may have access to. And there's a little bit of variability from school to school. Typically, a simple formula is used at a public university. A little bit more complicated formula might be used at a private college or university where they may actually consider things like home equity. I will say, and Alan, you mentioned this earlier, many of us don't have much home equity right now because of the downfall in the economy and what it did to the housing market. So a lot of institutions have backed away from that. But the federal government does place a very small calculator or amount of money they think should come from your investments and your savings. And issues and rules like this apply. The closer you are to retirement, the less money should come or would be calculated to come against your investments. There's a rule of thumb that we put in the book. Parents never, ever use your retirement money to pay for your son or daughter's education, because you need to be able to take care of yourself. You will become a burden for them. They'll be taking care of you if you've spent your retirement money. So there's a great application if you go to ed.gov, in other words, educational you know, is the keyword there, ed.gov, you'll find the FAFSA forecaster. And that's the F like Frank, A like Apple, F like Frank, S like Sam, A like Apple. That's the acronym for the document, the form that you fill out. It's online. But the FAFSA 4, so it's FAFSA with the number 4, and then the word forecaster. Mm-hmm. It's a tool. You can go online today. Your listener can go right online and fill out the FAFSA forecaster. It'll tell them what the expected contribution is from the family.
Okay. And
you don't have to guess anymore.
That's great. Now, for those of you, if you're not driving, you can actually go right now. You know, you can open up another window on your computer. You can go and you can check that out. Now, if you're driving or you can't write this down right now, you can always go to our website, Answers, the numeral 4, thefamilyblog.com, and we will have some of that information on, or we will also have on there, you can, if you go ahead and then click where you'll see where Ruth's interview is, you can go to her website, which is thefinancialaidhandbook.com. And then, Ruth, some of this information is on your website as well. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So there you go. All the information's there. Now, we have another question. And again, for the listeners out there, thank you so much. I appreciate the fact that you take the time to give us these questions. We will always do whatever we can to get them asked. This one says, my daughter is a junior in high school, and we are starting to look for college options. We are curious about your recommendations regarding, I think you just spoke about this, regarding in-state and out-of-state colleges. We have read a lot about kids dropping out of college after the first year. Are success rates higher if kids stay closer to home where they have more support?
Oh, what an excellent question. And the first answer is the student success rate or the retention rate is very personal. It goes back to doing a really great college search and finding a college or university that really matches the student. And there are some kids that just shouldn't go very far from home. They're not ready yet. They're not mature enough. They might be ready academically. And those kids should probably be within an hour or two's drive so they can see mom and dad and little brothers and sisters that they love to scream at, and they can pet their dogs and do the family things and transition slowly. There are some kids that are very mature. They're very ready to move, to get on an airplane and go across the country. And they tend to know who they are. There's a couple of things about in-state and out-of-state tuition that you need to know about. First of all, it's only the public universities that differentiate between a state resident and a non-resident. And, of course, that reason is because this, as a state resident, your tax dollars are contributing towards the paying the expenses of the public colleges and universities. And out of state, you're not a contributor, so you'll pay more. And those costs used to be about two-thirds of the cost, a sticker price against a private university, and boy, that line is blurring. They're looking very similar these days. For your listeners who are have kids coming up that are young teens and they're thinking back to what they paid for college when they were there, if you can remember, you'll be shocked and surprised by how the costs have increased dramatically in the last 15 years or so since maybe you made your last tuition payment. It's changed considerably, and there are a lot of good reasons. Part of that are the reasons costs have gone up everywhere, the cost of health care. If you think about colleges and universities, they're very employee-heavy or dense, mm-hmm. and so the majority of their expenses really are tied up in payroll. And so just paying for health care or helping their employees, their faculty, pay for health care is an issue for them as well. And the other big contributing factor is energy costs. You've got all these kids living in these residence halls, and you have to heat them and cool them. And so same reasons. The other part is that for the public universities, I would say when I started school, I grew up in Minnesota, and the University of Minnesota was probably funded about 80-85% from the taxpayers. And now I'd be surprised if even 25% of their funding came from a tax base or was taxpayer supported. Mm-hmm. That's changed dramatically as we've kind of run ourselves out of money in this country.
Now, speaking of in this country. What about international colleges? I'm seeing more and more advertisements for international colleges. How are they looked at here in this country or by employers in this country?
You know, that really depends on, I think, the program. But I think they're very well received. It's Carol's son attended the University of London School of Economics, and that's for a graduate program. And his degree is very, very highly, I guess you could say, appreciated by employers. But it's something that I didn't know about the schools in the UK is that their cost for people who are not citizens of the UK are actually very reasonable, and that was a very low cost program for one of the most prestigious economic degrees in the world, and that's something that, you know, was interesting to learn about. Carol actually worked for about 5 years as a school counselor in Brussels at two different American schools, so she had a lot more information than I had about that. When you think about around the world, there are, of course, so many students now who will spend a semester or a year studying abroad, mm-hmm. either in English or, if they're a foreign language major, in a different language. And that is very common, and that is a great resume builder,
okay.
because we are global citizens, and the more we experience outside of our own culture, the stronger we will be as individuals and, of course, as workers for our companies.
Absolutely. Now, is there a period of time that you have to plan on spending in that particular country, or is there a period of time that if you're there, you're considered a resident that may change the cost issues?
You know, Alan, I think country by country, those would be different answers.
Okay.
And generally, I think you would need to be a citizen or an individual who has already been sanctioned as a permanent resident of a country, as we have our green card permanent residents in the United States. And that's, frankly, in the U.S., you must be a green card holder or a citizen to enjoy the benefits of the federal and the state grant programs, and also the federal backed student loans.
Okay.
And so, and across the world, I think it's going to vary quite a bit, and very few students, we export very few of our young people to do a full degree program at another college or university in the country. And just recently, and it's interesting you've asked this question, because just recently, colleges and universities from other places in the world are targeting our youth for possible enrollment in their institutions. And depending on where you're going, the cost could be considerably less if you are ready to go, if you're mature enough, mm-hmm. if you can handle the cultural diversity and grow with it yourself as a human being, as a person, and embrace that and enjoy it, and handle the, you know, typically if you're going abroad, you're probably not, you might, you know, if you're affluent, you can come home for holidays, but not very likely to even come home at the holiday break in December. So you have to be ready to have an extended period of time away from your family. The political part of it is the other piece. I would really spend a lot of time on the U.S. government, State Department's website, mm-hmm. learning all I could about how welcome Americans are in different countries.
That's a good point.
Right. So it's a really big issue.
Now, one of the things that I think now we're all seeing is online education. We could probably do a whole show just on that, but if you could touch on that a little bit in regards to how online education is playing a part now in young people's education, actually, and older people's education.
And
really.
Older people's, yes. It's a very popular option for several things. Earning a full degree online, and if you're interested in doing that, if your readers are thinking about that, just make sure that you are doing a degree that is the equivalent of an on-campus or a residential-based program, so that you're doing it through an accredited school or college or university. We have national accrediting bodies that actually evaluate our universities and our colleges and determine if we're doing all the things we need to be doing to provide a high-quality education. So there are national standards for what you need to teach and what facilities you need to have and how you deliver the education you deliver. And so you start off with making sure that the school you're looking at is sound and stable and credible. And from there, think about what will it do for you. Often when you're when you're doing an online program, it's because maybe you're in a financial situation where you really have to work full-time. And so you're going to go to school part-time, and it's just incredibly convenient to either stay at your workstation at work and be online doing a course, or go home and feed everybody dinner and then do an hour or two's worth of schoolwork right there. It's very popular with traditional age college students for supplementing what they're already doing at their full-time residential college experience. It can be very inexpensive. It's a great way to knock off a couple of general educational requirements. So in a really hard semester where you have a lot of sciences, let's say, if you're pre-med, you might do an online course that doesn't, it gives you more flexibility. It doesn't require you sitting in a classroom at certain hours of the day.
Right.
And so that's an option, and they're usually affordable. And sometimes you're right at your own school. You can do their online coursework for no extra money. And, again, extend your day a little bit beyond the traditional class times that are offered for residential colleges.
Now, is there a site that people can go to determine which ones are nationally accredited or which accreditation location or which accreditation systems are considered valid or acceptable?
It would say right on the website for the college or university you're looking at, you should be able to just search for accreditation. It'll tell you which accreditations they have. It should be a primary one like North Central or South Central Association of Schools and Colleges, and a name like that. And then some of them will have, colleges and universities have individual or discipline-specific accreditation. There's, for example, in the business school world, there's a primary accreditation that only about 17% of the schools in this, actually in the world have for accreditation. It's very difficult to get. It's expensive because of the kinds of faculty you have to have on teaching at your university. And so the primary accreditation is a little bit different than that, and you'll find it on their website.
Okay. Now, and I noticed, and let's getting back to the book for a moment, and I noticed in the book, which is called the Financial Aid Handbook, I noticed that most of the Ivy League, maybe all of the Ivy League, and many of our best known or largest universities and private research universities are not on your list. Tell us a little bit about, maybe why they're not on the list.
Sure. The list was conceived, the 60 best bet schools are schools that will fund their favorites. And the Ivy League schools and the near Ivy schools like Northwestern University or Washington University in St. Louis that are not one of the eight traditional, Ivy Leaguers, but they're like them in terms of being in the top 10 or 15 schools listed on everybody's list in the country. They don't have to give away money to fill their classes. It's pretty much that simple.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't reward your academic prowess and your valedictorian status and your national merit finalist status and your very high test score just for being strong academically, because they have such a strong brand, as we call it. They're so well known and so many people want to go there. There's so much demand that they don't have to give scholarships away. They do give very generous need-based financial aid. So like that person who sent a note about three kids and were getting worried. If you have financial need, and your kids reach that academic benchmark where they can get into an Ivy or a near Ivy, like the two I mentioned, then they will fund you to go there based on need. Your kids will take out some loan money, but it'll be reasonable. It probably won't be more than $5,500 a year, unless you're very, very poor, and then even the Ivies will reduce the amount of debt that kids have to take. And so we didn't put them in there because if you get in, it actually can be in the Reach School, they're not going to fund you unless you have a ton of financial need. When you filled out the free application for federal student aid, it showed that you have zero money to contribute from your parents and yourself. In other words, you don't have any savings. Your parents have an income that's probably adjusted gross income below $30,000 a year. And so if you're a zero-need person, you might be able to afford these schools. But they're not funding their favorites. The schools we've listed are also schools that have an average student loan of less than $8,000 per year.
Okay.
And so that's very important because one of the basic premises of our book is the $8,000 debt challenge. And so we didn't list them. Also, another thing that's kind of interesting, those schools don't need that kind of publicity. Everybody know, you know, John and Jane Q Public on the street corner. If you said, name 10 schools, when they got done naming their state universities that they know, they might know Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, Columbia, Penn. They might be able to get a little bit into that list. So they don't really need the help.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Now, is there any other criteria that helped you in your selection for the colleges that made the best section?
Passion. As we looked, we reviewed all 4,409 colleges and universities. We sat with the big book, and we were on the web. It actually was a fun but a very lengthy process for us, yes. And the schools we selected have a very clear sense of who they are and a commitment to their mission and a passion for their students. And hence, they put money into funding their favorites or students who are a good match for them. You know, we like to talk about the College of Worcester, who has, they're in our Best Bets book. They're a very fine, a selective college, and they actually have a scholarship for bagpipe players.
Wow.
So, yeah, because it's part of their history and tradition, and I've been on that, I worked on that campus for almost a year, and about 4 p.m, I'd open up my window so I could hear the bagpipe band practicing out on the lawn. Unbelievable. Just the ambiance of that is something I can't express in words.
Well, out of all the information that you provide in the book, what do you think is the single most important takeaway that students and their parents can get from reading your book?
I don't care who you are or where you live, you can go to college. You might have to do it the hard way or the slow way, but you can get in and you can get money. And you can achieve that. A college graduate will generally make about $1 million a year more than a high school graduate, and will, in answering all of the life satisfaction surveys and interest inventories, I would imagine you've covered some of this in your shows, typically college graduates will respond that they're happier with their lives, they're more satisfied with their work, they're just the status of their well-being is a little bit stronger. And is it the college experience, or is it learning how to be a more global citizen? Is it, you know, earning more money? What is it that impacts that satisfaction rating being higher than the high school graduates? Well, there's a lot of research out there, but in general, we know that college pays off. We know you can get a plan. It's really a big part of why we wrote the book. We're keeping our day jobs because the book is an incredible value. If you go out to purchase it, in other words, this was a labor of love for Carol and I after 35 years of watching kids and families just not be able to figure it out. So okay. We hope that people find it useful.
And where can they purchase it? Can they purchase it through your website? Can you get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble? Where can they find the book?
All of the above. In fact, on our website, we've got a full panel that shows, you know, click here and you can go to your independent bookseller if you like to buy from your local, you know, privately owned. You can get it at Amazon. They've got a great price. It's at Barnes & Noble. Just scoop it up on your way through, have a coffee and sit down with it.
All right. Well, that sounds...
And the website also is going to provide some other resources. For example, you can go, we have under resources, we have a button for state by state. And it shows a map of the United States. So you can click on your state, and if you happen to be in California, it will show you how to get in touch with your state's student aid commission and learn more about merit grants or need-based grants that are available for residents of your state.
That sounds great. And I think one other area, I mean, what about more of like the sort of the trade school type of kid that just says, you know what, you know, I've thought about college. I don't think it's right for me right now because for whatever reason, you know, what they want is, you know, auto mechanic and or something like that. And I have a thought in my mind, and I just kind of want you to sort of tell me if I'm on the right track. Isn't it still better for them to go ahead, go to school, get a degree, even if they're going to then go to this trade school? Isn't it going to help them achieve what it is they want quicker and reach higher heights in whatever it is that's their chosen profession?
I would say bingo on all accounts. I think that's absolutely right. And we know from over the years, having worked with different schools, those that have a trade degree or a very focused specialization, mm-hmm. you go in, you start off typically, or even at an apprentice level, so you're learning in an applied way as well as some of the theory or the specialized knowledge that you need. So when you finish that program, you're going to go out and be the best tradesperson you can be, and your phone is going to be ringing off the hook because that's who people want to hire. At least that's who I want to hire when I need specialized work done. Absolutely.
All right. And everybody, you heard it here. You want to get hired? Go to college, okay?
Yeah.
You want to go to college and you want to spend the amount of money that you can afford, buy the book. It is the Financial Aid Handbook. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on. All right. Have a
sure.
great week. And everybody out there, do the same. Have a wonderful week and listen to us next week. Take care now.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk. Right here on LA Talk Radio.